The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom, Iranian citizens risk their lives to take to the streets.
Iranian people are tired of their government failing them. Iranian people are tired of having a government that is not representative of who they are. One of the most inspiring things I saw was a woman climbing up on a pole, and she tore down a sign that the government put up that said, "Death to America."
Democrats continue down the path of impeachment.
The entire mentality since election night 2016 is that history went wrong.
The whistleblower remains shielded from accountability.
He does not have a legal right to remain confidential.
And Democrats put their agenda ahead of the country.
We're not even taking care of the stuff here at home.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. And follow the program as well at Town Hall Review. While the media focused on the impeachment in the House of Representatives, lost in the news was a very important story out of Iran. Thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Iranian citizens took to the streets across the country to protest the government's decision to raise gas prices by 50%. While the price of gas was still extraordinarily low in Iran compared to other places around the globe, few in the now impoverished country can afford it due to the sanctions imposed on the government by the United States. Iran spends freely on military and terror, not on the people who need it the most. And the people responded. Brian Hook, special representative to Iran, joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show just days after the protests began to explain the imploding situation in the Islamic Republic of Iran. News was made vis-a-vis Iran and nuclear waivers. Would you explain, especially in mind, Steelers fans are listening, they don't understand this stuff, what the waivers were and why we took one away?
Well, yeah, good question. Some time ago, Iran built a nuclear facility in the town of Fordo. This was a secret underground bunker that the regime built to conduct secret uranium enrichment work. And what Secretary Pompeo did was he took action to end the sanctions waiver on that nuclear facility, and he did it to send a clear message that Iran's effort at nuclear extortion is not going to be tolerated.
Now, there remain three other waivers in place for three other facilities, including the Tehran Research Reactor, which may be part of Iran's nuclear development. Are those under review?
Oh, they're under regular review. When Secretary Pompeo, over a year ago, put out his list of 12 demands, at the very top is that the world's leading sponsor of terrorism cannot be allowed to enrich uranium, and they should never pursue plutonium processing. So when we heard in the case of Fordo that the Iranian regime was resuming enrichment at a facility that used to be secret, he took action and then ended that waiver. We do need to restore the UN Security Council standard of no enrichment for the Iranian regime.
Are the other three facilities on the table imminently, Brian Hook?
Well, it's really on a day-to-day basis. The secretary has sanctioned a number of nuclear scientists working on the nuclear program. So he's also ended a number of nuclear waivers. You have essentially three left. The thing that we're looking at is any time there is an activity that we think is going to reduce the breakout time, the nuclear breakout time for Iran to get to a nuclear weapon, we move in very quickly.
Now, the country is racked by demonstrations, if we are to believe reports on the Internet, but they have also, the mullahs have also shut down the Internet, so our information is coming in piecemeal. What do you understand the situation to be, broadly speaking, in Iran?
These are massive protests across the breadth and depth of the country. There are now reports of as many as a few hundred Iranians killed by the regime. And what these protests started 3 days ago is in response to gas hikes. They increased the price of gasoline. But these protests have now turned into anti-regime protests. And we have seen pictures of Iranians burning, images of the Ayatollah, and all over the country. These are huge protests. The Iranian people are tired of their government failing them. The Iranian people are tired of having a government that is not representative of who they are. One of the most inspiring things I saw was a woman climbing up on a pole, and she tore down a sign that the government put up that said, "Death to America."
Now, Brian Hook, we have seen regimes collapse. Is regime collapse actually possible in Iran?
These things are very hard to predict, but we have put Iran really on a dilemma, the Iranian regime on the horns of a dilemma. They can either spend money on guns in Damascus, or they can spend it on butter in Tehran. And after the Iran nuclear deal, they were able to do both. The days of them doing both are over, and now their proxies are weaker. The regime is in its worst economic condition in its history. They're now at negative 12% GDP. That number is going to get worse. President Trump has put in place sanctions that have no historic precedent on Iran, and it is tying up the regime in a big way, and it's very hard for them to run their expansionist revolutionary foreign policy with impunity.
Now, Brian Hook, in the past, the Trump-Pompeo sanctions that you have been implementing on a day-to-day basis led to an attack on a U.S. drone, led to an attack on Saudi Arabia. It led to aggression in the Gulf. Do you expect that Iran will react to the revocation of the waiver for sanctions on Fordow with additional provocations?
I don't think that the regime has the bandwidth to manage any other problem. Their circuit boards are overloaded right now. We have protests in Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, in Yemen. You're seeing more positive trend lines there. And so when you look at the Iranian Shia crescent that they are trying to create, this arc that stretches from Lebanon all the way down to Yemen, they are experiencing massive headwinds in each of these countries. And so this is a choice that the president put in front of the regime when he came into office. You can either start behaving like a normal nation, or you can watch your economy collapse.
Now, the New York Times published a story on Monday. The Iran cable secret documents show how Tehran wields power in Iraq. Does the New York Times get it right in this story, Brian Hook?
Well, the period that it covers was during the Obama administration, where I think we were outmaneuvered by the Iranians. I think President Trump has put an end to that. And now we see protests, huge protests in Iraq. Iraqi people want their country back. And yesterday, Secretary Pompeo announced his support for the protesters in Iraq. And he also said that the United States will sanction any Iraqi officials who are stealing the wealth of the Iraqi people or who are colluding with Iran in order to undermine the sovereignty and the security of the government of Iraq.
Meanwhile, back home, an impeachment has completely dominated the House of Representatives. And this week did not go well for Democrats. It turns out that they have very little to justify this national charade, and their star witness, Gordon Sondland, wasn't much of a star. The highly respected Attorney General William Barr says the Democrats are simply trying to sabotage the administration with no care for what this does to the country. I spoke with National Review's Jim Garrity on The Hugh Hewitt Show. William Barr, a great intellectual, former attorney general, goes to the Federalist Society, and this deserves some unpacking, Jim Garrity. The Federalist Society is a group of mainstream center-right lawyers, professors, academics, and students that's been around for 30 years. I've never joined it because I don't believe in joining anything if you're going to be in media, but they are just mainstream center-right, old school. They get together once a year and they nerd out over things like the Dormant Commerce Clause and, you know, incorporation and stuff like that.
Enhanced rescission authority.
Yeah, it's what they do. And that's okay. William Barr gave a speech to it, causing the left to melt down. Here's 50 seconds of it, because it is really causing the left to unglue. Cut number 12.
Unfortunately, just in the past few years, we have seen this these conflicts take on an entirely new character. Immediately after President Trump won election, opponents inaugurated what they called the resistance. And they rallied around an explicit strategy of using every tool and maneuver to sabotage the functioning of the executive branch and his administration. The fact of the matter is that in waging a scorched earth, no-holds-barred war of resistance against this administration, it is the left that is engaged in the systematic shredding of norms and undermining the rule of law.
Now, Jim Garrity, in the last presidency, we had Democrats complaining continually of Mitch McConnell's 2011 statement that we want to make him one-term president. But that was political. This, what Barr is alleging, is not political. He's alleging, and I believe Andrew McCarthy, your colleague at National Review, is expanding on this, that the Democrats will pay a price for refusing the peaceful transition of power, that they just never bought into Trump, and that they have done everything they can to stop him. What make you of the president, of the attorney general's argument?
Well, the first thing is that there are a lot of cases where Trump has not hired the best and the brightest. The Omarosas, the Scaramucci's, the times this administration has felt like a reality TV, like an episode of The Apprentice. In Barr, he's got the best and the brightest. He's
yep.
got his number one draft pick, who is not just loyal to the president and, you know, on board with the vast majority, if not all, of his agenda, but who knows Washington, who knows how to use the levers of power. He's been in this position before under George H.W. Bush. He knows what he's doing, and he knows how to get what he wants from within the system and from outside the system. And I think you can characterize him as a true believer. And as for this argument, look, the argument for impeachment now would be a lot stronger if Democrats had not started an impeachment petition on January 20th, 2017. There was a public policy polling, which is a Democratic firm, did a poll in like March 2017. The president's been in office for about 6 weeks, and nearly half of Democrats believe Trump should be impeached.
I think that what Barr is making, and your colleague Andrew McCarthy, and it hadn't really occurred to me, they're going to make an issue. After the economy, national security, judges, deregulation, they're going to say, and by the way, the left wing of the Democratic Party is unhinged from the constitutional norm of the peaceful transition of power.
Somewhat, yeah. The entire mentality since election night 2016 is that history went wrong. That was not supposed to happen. Like, for everyone who's furious about having a president who they can't stand and who they think is constantly wrong and all that stuff, I'm younger than you, but I lived through Obama. I lived through Clinton. I was even young enough to, I was a kid during Jimmy Carter.
Yep.
Everybody gets a president they don't like. Everybody gets a president they think is an idiot. This is not something, shocking that's never happened before.
Coming up, while the House debates impeachment,
but we're not even taking care of the stuff here at home.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. On Wednesday, during the impeachment hearings, a California Democrat, Eric Swalwell, compared the whistleblower to a person who pulls the fire alarm during a fire. An interesting effort to paint the whistleblower as a bystander who saves lives by alerting others to danger. But the reality in this case is that the whistleblower isn't the one pulling the alarm so much as the one who described the fire nobody else saw, accusing a specific person of lighting the alleged fire and covering up the lighting of the fire. Imagine being accused of all this and not being able to question the accuser. Andrew McCarthy, former assistant United States attorney and the writer for the National Review and a Fox News specialist, discussed the whistleblower while on Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson. They began on Adam Schiff's refusal to release transcripts of the behind-closed-doors testimony.
Republicans still have this sort of running complaint against Schiff, which is release these transcripts. They turn these transcripts around so that they can be included in the discussion in real time, we're going to have this testimony, then we're going to decide if this is somebody that's helpful to the case to call, then I'll decide if the transcripts will be released. Release the transcripts. It doesn't take long to type this thing up.
Yeah, they're absolutely right about that. they should have the transcripts available to them when they are examining the other witnesses, because the information now, you know, the way this would work if the federal rules of evidence applied, which they don't in a hearing like this, would be that you can't impeach a witness with another witness's statement. But you can use the information that you get from other witnesses as a good faith basis to challenge the testimony of other witnesses. The problem that the Democrats have had from the beginning here, and I think the problem that the public will have with the process here, is that it's not fair. Schiff has taken to himself the ability to pick and choose what information gets put out, the ability to pick and choose what witnesses are allowed to testify. Nobody thinks he is an honest broker. He's a political, partisan, hardball operative. And if I were the Republicans, I would, since they have to play the hand they're dealt, and they, you know, he can block them from calling witnesses, I would make him the focus of the hearing, because he is the focus of the hearing. He's sitting there in the middle. He's the most imposing, consistent figure in this whole process. So I would keep bringing it back to him that he's been utterly unfair and that he's running essentially a kangaroo proceeding.
Yeah, I mean, you had Jennifer Williams, Pence staffer. She was, you know, deposed on Saturday. I would like to have her testimony be public. But what about the whistleblower? Do you think he should be unmasked and we should have a public, you know, hearing for him?
Yes. I think, first of all, and it should be done before Vindman testifies. The game that the Democrats are playing is they apparently, you know, you could see this in Vindman's, the transcript of his closed door testimony. When they start to ask about the whistleblower and whether he leaked stuff to the whistleblower and whether he's in cahoots with the whistleblower, Schiff jumps in and cuts it off on the ground that they're trying to reveal the whistleblower and he's got a legal right to remain confidential. He does not have a legal right to remain confidential. First of all, the whistleblower statute that they're talking about does not apply to this guy, because this is, we're not talking about intelligence activities. This is the president dealing in foreign policy with a head of state. So the statute doesn't even apply to him. But even if it did, it only imposes a confidentiality requirement on the inspector general of the intelligence committee or community. And even with respect to the inspector general, confidentiality can be pierced if he thinks under the circumstances it's unavoidable that the guy will become public, or, and this is very important, if the matter, if there was any way the matter was likely to be referred to a court for trial or to the Justice Department for potential prosecution. What that underscores is people's desire to be confidential is something that we defer to only so far and no further. Once you're in a position where your information is relevant to an important proceeding like a judicial trial, or I would argue like an impeachment proceeding, you lose your interest in being confidential has to take a backseat to the public's interest and the proceedings' interest in getting at the truth.
You might wonder, justifiably, is Congress getting anything else done while preparing and performing for this impeachment circuit? I asked that question of Georgia Republican Doug Collins Wednesday morning. Now, step number one would require Adam Schiff to really do some soul searching and realize this is very destructive what he has launched here. And I believe Tim Morrison yesterday, I want to play for you the key clip from yesterday's hearing. This is Tim Morrison, cut number 28, please.
As I stated during my deposition, I feared at the time of the call on July 25th how its disclosure would play in Washington's political climate. My fears have been realized. I understand the gravity of these proceedings, but I beg you not to lose sight of the military conflict underway in eastern Ukraine today, the ongoing illegal occupation of Crimea, and the importance of reform of Ukraine's politics and economy. Every day that the focus of discussion involving Ukraine is centered on these proceedings instead of those matters is a day when we are not focused on the interests Ukraine, the United States, and Western-style liberalism share.
Congressman Collins, let me expand on that. Every day that Adam Schiff runs up the tab, the people who are going to pay that are the people of Ukraine, Venezuela, Hong Kong, Israel, our military that hasn't gotten an appropriation or anything other than a continuing resolution or a pay. Do not they realize what they are doing?
I wish I could say that all of them do. Some of them do not. They have so focused, and so this is something to realize, and this is the sad reality, that this Speaker Pelosi is a, and I'll just give her credit, she's an excellent politician. She's an excellent tactician. She's proven that before, but she's also willing to do something that most leaders are not. She's willing to put the House on the line. She did it with Obamacare. She did it with the CFPB. She did it in 10 when she said, I'm ideologically bent. This is what I want to see. And if it costs me the House, fine. She has now done the same thing with impeachment because she is so invested in, I believe, in the presidential election of next year that she's willingly put the House on the line. And you know how I know this is not necessarily these impeachment hearings. It's exactly what you just said. We're running on CRs. Did you know, really, and I had this, I had asked a member of the Appropriations Committee the other day, I said, when did y'all meet, you know, to discuss, you know, fixing the CR or anything? He, and the person told me, we had not met as a committee since June. That Wow. should shock everybody in this country, that we have been dealing with appropriations and funding of government, and the Appropriations Committee, Nita Lowey, who's the chairman, has not even called her committee together. This is being decided at the highest level. So don't blame committee members. Blame the Speaker and the leadership of the Democratic Party and others who are not getting input. So this week we're passing a CR to push it down the line 30 days. And it's just, this is what's not getting done. And in my committee in judiciary, we've not done anything all year, and all of a sudden we figured out that we actually have to pass things dealing with things that are expiring at the end of the year. We've not done any of this so far. So this is who's dying. Not only the folks that you talked about around the world, where we're not focusing on being the bright, shining light that we are, but we're not even taking care of the stuff here at home.
Congressman, Senator Scott was on earlier today, and he explained in very down-to-earth terms, when you do a CR, the military is locked into what they spent money on last year, stuff they don't want to spend money on this year. They are locked into last year's pay. The military doesn't get a pay raise. They are locked into weapon systems that are not what the weapon systems they want to fund. They're locked into all the mistakes that were made last year when the Congress does a CR. They are hurting America's national security.
They are.
Coming up.
When Chick-fil-A says it will no longer give to the Salvation Army, you know that it is a watershed moment in American life.
A troubling decision by Chick-fil-A when Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. In 2012, Chick-fil-A President Dan Cathy, when asked about same-sex marriage, explained why he believes in the biblical definition of marriage. The left has not let him rest since. Chick-fil-A has been the target of protests, shut out of airports, banned from some college campuses. And at the same time, their brand has grown. They're now the most beloved fast food chain in America and, store by store, the most successful. So it was quite a shock when earlier in the week, Chick-fil-A announced that they were cutting financial ties to a number of terrific organizations that the far left has deemed anti-LGBTQ. Among those, the Salvation Army and the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Those who've defended and stood by Chick-fil-A over the years felt betrayed. Here's my friend and colleague, Dennis Prager.
Fear of the left is greater than fear of the Lord, even at Chick-fil-A. They won't give to the Salvation Army anymore because LGBTQ organizations have gone after them. Wow. They won't give to the Paul Anderson Youth Home or the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, which opposes same-sex marriage. The vast majority of Americans opposed same-sex marriage, I would say 10 years ago. What do you think happened exactly? Americans all became wise? They changed their mind on something that had been virtually unanimous. Marriage was between a man and a woman. So we're just better than everyone who lived before us? That's what the left believes. It's an amazing thing. And I say this, as I tell you so often, my wife and I are godparents to a gay couple's children. We love the couple. We love the children. And they know that for religious reasons, we believe that marriage should be between a man and a woman. What am I supposed to do with my religious beliefs? Say they're not popular? But it's almost always like that. The masses are led by whatever force is dominant in that society, which is, of course, today leftism. And that's it. And they think they're morally superior. But they really, it's a very interesting problem for Christians and Jews, because if they claim that they take the Bible seriously, it's clear that in that work, God wants man and woman to marry. Judaism and Christianity have not been wrong for 3,000 and 2,000 years, respectively. Of course, that's what the left holds. They're wrong, we're right. We know better. That is the motto of the left. We know better. But the Salvation Army, that's the Chick-fil-A will not give to the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. We made multi-year commitments to both organizations, and we fulfilled those obligations in 2018. A representative for Chick-fil-A said, saying the chain will now focus its charitable donations on, quote, education, homelessness, and hunger. Boy, have they been leftized. Wow. Wow. There's no question we know that as we go into new markets, we need to be clear about who we are. Chick-fil-A President and Chief Operating Officer Tim Tassopoulos said. Isn't that something? Do you really know who you are now? Chick-fil-A has a long history of being on the receiving end of criticism from LGBT rights groups. In March, the San Antonio City Council took steps to effectively ban Chick-fil-A from San Antonio's airport. After the company donated $2 million to the Christian charities it no longer supports. Wow. The left is so filled with hate that they believe that the Salvation Army is a hate organization. We are really living through times where good is called evil and evil is called good. I can't think of an organization that is kinder than the Salvation Army. The Salvation Army has done so much more for humanity, for this country, for the poor, for the needy, than the LGBTQ groups. To give to Christian organizations is now considered forbidden. When Chick-fil-A says it will no longer give to the Salvation Army, you know that it is a watershed moment in American life. Why all of a sudden does Christianity lose to the marketplace? What is the use of religion if when it's tested, it caves?
Coming up.
And they just at that point said, look, we are not trying to undermine the president. What we're trying to do is save our country.
My conversation with former Ambassador Nikki Haley. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. While ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley and President Trump seemed, at least for a bit, to contradict each other on whether there would be sanctions against Russia for supporting and protecting Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow suggested Nikki Haley might have been confused. Her response was short and commanding. With all due respect, I don't get confused. With that, much of America saw what those close to her already knew. She's a tough woman with great leadership quality. With all due respect became the title of her new book. She joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. So I want to start, oddly enough, with the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA. Would you tell people what the controversy about UNRWA is?
Well, it's an agency that's meant to take care of Palestinian refugees, but it's unlike any other refugee system out there. I mean, first of all, you know, we had numerous problems with them. So we multiple times tried to get them to reform, and they just wouldn't. And on top of that, they were anti-U.S. And so it was something I fought hard for to get them to reform. And when they didn't, I fought hard to get the aid pulled. You know, the thing is, they just wanted the money, and they didn't want any questions asked. And there was a lot of danger in that. One, it's taxpayer dollars, and you don't want money going to anything that would be helping terrorists or an organization that's just losing money. I mean, since I had that fight trying to pull the money, the executive director has been fired. You know, multiple things have happened in reference to that. I mean, you know, I think you should always be making sure that every dollar we send goes and is spent in a way that the American people would want it to be.
Well, what struck me, Ambassador Haley, reading with all due respect, a couple of things. We'll come to the controversy about the money in a second, but what you describe about the United States trying to get accountability and corruption, stop the abuse, is very similar to what the United States has been trying to accomplish in Ukraine. Have you seen the parallel to this?
Well, I think we've seen it in multiple areas where we give aid is that we don't want to give aid to places that are involved in corruption. We don't want to give aid to places where we think it's going to line someone's pockets. And I think that should always be the case.
So Nancy Pelosi says the phone call the president had with President Zelensky, where he congratulates him and then says, I'd like a favor, and asks him to investigate corruption, whose name is Biden in this case, Hunter Biden and Burisma. Do you think that's bribery, as Nancy Pelosi said, or is that just what we do in foreign affairs?
It was two presidents having a conversation and talking about, I mean, look, the president of Ukraine that just got elected because he was going to curb corruption. So for the president to be talking to him about corruption, this was exactly what he was elected to do. So, you know, for him to bring that up, that was just one more level of corruption that, you know, I think needed to be addressed.
So you believe, do you reject out of hand Nancy Pelosi's charge of bribery?
Yes. I mean, because nothing, I mean, look, they can call it whatever they want, but I choose not to go by the words. I choose to go by the facts. And when you look at the transcript, I mean, no investigation happened. The money flowed, and nowhere in there is any kind of threat or demand that it have to get done.
Unbelievably, because you wrote this book before this Ukraine controversy surfaced, the UNRWA conversation that is the most controversial part of, with all due respect, is exactly the Ukraine situation set in the Palestinian territory. It's the same thing.
It is, yes.
All right, now, the controversy is you wanted to cut off all $120 million. Rex Tillerson did not want to cut it. Rex Tillerson crashes a meeting. John Kelly, the chief of staff, is there. The president says, work it out. What happens after that?
Well, you know, the president was leaning my way on pulling the aid, and he finally just said, okay, you guys go figure it out. We then go to John Kelly's office, and for almost 2 hours, you know, they continue to tell me why they want to go ahead and fund the aid, you know, and I was pushing the fact that, look, we just talked to the president, and the president says that he agrees that we should pull the aid. And this wasn't the first time, Hugh. I mean, this was like constant, that every single time the president would make a decision, Rex just didn't agree with it. And so, you know, everything was always discussed. Everybody's voice was heard. But when we'd walk out the Situation Room from having a discussion, many times they would stall or stop or just not do what the president had requested. And so then finally, I think that they were exhausted from talking to me, and they just at that point said, look, we are not trying to undermine the president. What we're trying to do is save our country. And, you know, this is something where we don't think that he knows what's best. And Rex went on to say, look, if I didn't do the things that I did to stop his efforts, people would die.
I am surprised that General Kelly in your book is portrayed as undermining the president and, in fact, working across purposes. Is that what you intended to say?
Well, and let me make this clear, because I think it's really important. I think both of these men wanted to serve their country and wanted to serve it well. I think both of them were patriots in wanting to do that. This was an issue of, they weren't saying that we had a rogue president or, you know, someone who was unfit for the position. These were men who disagreed with pulling out of the Iran deal, disagreed of pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement, disagreed, you know, with whether it be UNRWA or whether it be moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So these were policy differences. These weren't anything more than that. And I don't know exactly where John Kelly fell on all of those issues. I just know that he and Rex were very close and very tight, and the two of them worked closely together. And it was General Kelly that said, look, I don't even think the president knows if congressional people are elected or not, and I spend every day trying to keep him from doing, you know, things he shouldn't be doing. And that's when, you know, we talked about the fact these are policy differences. And, you know, I've long said, and I still believe, that they have every right to have policy differences, but they should take those to the president or they should quit.
But are you suggesting insubordination by General Kelly?
Well, I'm giving you the facts. That's what happened. I'll let you guys decide. And I think they honestly thought they were doing what was right.
Now, on page 151, your conversation with General Kelly and Secretary of State Tillerson goes on for over an hour. Did they say we are not going to follow the president's orders? Did they really go to insubordination? It's actually astonishing to me. Not that they're working around and doing bureaucratic tricks, but insubordination is different, Ambassador Haley.
Well, you tell me. So we leave the meeting. The president had agreed that we would pull the money for UNRWA. A few days later, half the money was given anyway.
They defied the president.
Yes.
To hear my conversation with Governor Nikki Haley, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
The word bribery appears in these 3,500 pages exactly one time. And ironically, it appears not in a description of President Trump's alleged conduct. It appears in a description of Vice President Biden's alleged conduct.
One last word on the impeachment when the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, a special edition of the program with author and apologist John Lennox. We'll look at the world of science relative to the world of faith.
Science as culture owes a vast debt to the Christian faith for a very simple reason. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. They are an intelligent product.
And we'll look at the limits of what science can explain about the world as we know it and what it really can't do.
The more you understand, the more you admire the genius of the God that did it that way.
And is science displacing belief in God?
Why do I think that science can bury atheism? It's because science can be done.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you were to ask 10 American citizens why the House is seeking to impeach President Donald Trump, you might get 10 different answers. And if you were one of the few who watched every day of the hearing so far, you probably noticed there seems to be a different reason every day, indeed with every witness. There's a reason for that. Salem host Larry Elder explains.
John Ratcliffe is the Republican from Texas. I like him. He got the two morning witnesses to admit that they never used the word bribery to discuss Trump's offensive conduct.
The word bribery appears in these 3,500 pages exactly one time. And ironically, it appears not in a description of President Trump's alleged conduct. It appears in a description of Vice President Biden's alleged conduct. This is important because as early as next week, my Democratic colleagues are going to say, we need to vote on the evidence from this impeachment inquiry, on the impeachment of the president for bribery. And they're going to send a report to the Judiciary Committee. And because there's more Democrats than Republicans, it's going to likely pass. And when that happens, the American people need to be clear that when the Democrats, what they are describing as bribery, not a single witness is describing as bribery.
Isn't that a bit of a problem? Nancy Pelosi accuses the president now of bribery. Not a single witness has described what the president did, whether they liked it or not, as bribery.
We've heard many times in the course of this proceeding that the facts of the president are not in dispute. But the American people are asking, if the facts are the same, why do the crimes that the president is being accused of keep changing? Why do we go from quid pro quo to extortion, now to bribery? Chairman Nunes told you the answer. The answer is polling. Washington Times asked Americans what would be the most damning accusation, and it didn't come back.
He said Washington Times, he meant Washington Post.
Pro quo, it didn't come back extortion, it came back bribery. So this case is all about bribery. Look, it's bad enough that the Democrats have forbidden White House lawyers from participating in this proceeding. It's hard enough to defend yourself without your lawyers present. But what's even worse is trying to defend yourself against an accusation that keeps changing in the middle of the proceeding. If Democrats accuse the president of a high crime or impeachable offense, he at least ought to know which one it is. And when Speaker Pelosi says this is all about bribery, she's promised us evidence of bribery that would be compelling and overwhelming, and instead, it's invisible. I yield back.
Can you imagine if Republicans tried to impeach Obama and kept switching the reasons? Well, we think it's a quid pro quo. Well, we think it's extortion. Well, we think it's bribery. Well, we think it's emoluments clause. Well, we think he violated campaign finance laws.
We do not
Are
have
you
time
kidding
for this
me?
Kind of silliness.
Country would be on fire.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Posey, and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.